Does the SAP community get together? You're all very like working hard on your projects or in your consultancies, and there's not really a platform that you can share and listen to other leaders. So we started interviewing senior leaders, and we started sharing that with the community. And 60 episodes later, this is the first episode that we're doing live, and we wanted to keep it really small and intimate. And like I said, thank you for attending. Paul, I know you said your mother-in-law's at home, and that's why you've attended. So, thank you for coming. But we wanted to focus on value, and we've got a few stories on where that's happened, whether it be candidates that have listened to senior leaders on the podcast and used that in interviews and managed to secure the role. I think Matt, you mentioned that before, which is great. There was another bit of value with Mark Allman. Mark works for EY. We interviewed him from an architect's point of view. And Mark, I think you was on a kickoff session with a customer and they recognized you.
Yeah, like I was about to introduce myself and she was like, I listen to your podcast. Okay. What more to say?
That's right.
Hopefully
it went well.
That was awesome.
So again, it's value again. And that's what we want to do. And we're going to continue to do that. And the SAP team here at Precision, we sat down and we've identified that the avalanche of projects is coming over the next few years. And we want to create a forum where we can share knowledge and share insights from senior leaders like Bruce. Okay. Now, one thing that we're doing as well with that avalanche of projects that's coming, we've looked at all 60 podcasts and we're creating little 30-second videos. And we're going to do the same with Bruce. So no pressure, Bruce, tonight. But we're going to create 30-second nuggets of gold, we call them. And we're going to put it on a landing page called the S4 Do's and Don'ts landing page, whether it be change or data or how to set up a project or governance or an architect's point of view. So little small 30-second videos. And the whole aim of that is if I'm a program manager or I'm in a business and I'm looking to implement SAP, we want a one-stop shop where they're listening to the community and listening to senior leaders and making more informed decisions, and that's what we want to do. So at this point, I just want to say thank you to Kira. She's here, our lovely marketing manager.
Thank you, Kira.
Thank you, Kira.
Kira's created this page, and it looks unbelievable. So once we finish this with Bruce, do the 30-second videos, and that's going to go live. So if I ask one thing, just please like, share, or comment when you see that. Obviously, if you're connected...
Yeah.
Subscribe, yeah.
That's right. If you do like, if you don't, then...
No, like it anyway, please.
Exactly. Like it anyway.
That's one thing that we do ask. Obviously, if you're connected to anyone at Precision, you do get bombarded on social. We are aware of that.
Sorry,
yeah. please like, share and comment. But over to Sara, and you're going to introduce...
I am. I don't think I need to introduce them to anyone in the room, but for those watching at home, thank you so much for tuning in. And I think when we started to call people, letting them know that we were going to do a live podcast, and I mentioned your name, Bruce, it was like at some point in his 30 plus year career, I hope you don't mind me saying 30 plus.
Not at all.
Everyone had worked with you in some way, shape or form. And there was not a name that I called that wasn't like Bruce McKinnon. Wow, I've not heard that name in years. So I thought I'd hand it over to you. It's obviously been so long, but you've come out of retirement. Where have you landed yourself?
I've retired from Accenture 2 years ago, where I was running the SAP practice across Asia-Pac. And about 6 months into retirement, I was contacted by an old friend of mine. I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning, Phil Miltiades, who I used to work with at SAP for many years. He is now the Asia-Pac head of a small software company, smaller than SAP, but it's called SNP. It's been around for a long time. We'll probably get to that, I guess, through the questions and so forth. But he asked me, he took me to lunch. For those of you who know Phil, he's a very good host. So we went to a very nice restaurant. We had some very nice food and a couple of bottles of very nice wine. And then he made his pitch in terms of asking me to help him out. So anyway, a couple of conversations later, I help him out a day or two a month. So it's very, very small, very flexible, which suits me down to the ground. And it's helping with strategy. It's helping with recruiting. It's helping with partner relationships. Mm. So it's been a lot of fun. I've been able to go to a few SAP events, which has been good, and just sort of keep in touch or keep connected to the ecosystem, which has been great.
And tell us like a bit about your background. I mean, again, you would have met or worked with these people for years, but fill us in.
Well, yeah, it's, as you say, 30 years plus. So I actually started my career as a graduate with Arthur Andersen back in the late 80s. And I was a programmer. I spent a couple of years programming Vax Basic, actually, for those, and I'll show my age, at Partner Housing here in New South Wales. And then as the, you know, fortune sort of prevails, and it's probably been the same with everybody's career here, I was asked to go onto a SAP project at Esso here in Sydney, which was an R2 project. And back then, back in those days, this is 1991, the biggest SAP customers globally were the big oil companies. So Esso, and I went from Esso to Caltex. I configured a module of R2 called RKP. I don't know if anybody has heard of it. Yep, there you go. it's Capital Project Accounting. And of course, I was an IT graduate. I knew nothing about business, and you sort of have to learn very quickly about what the business processes are. And then I was moved off an SAP project, so I promptly resigned and went to Pricewaterhouse in Melbourne. And I worked on other projects like Shell and Visi, and I project managed the first Visi R3 implementation, which was very interesting, and et cetera, et cetera. Probably the biggest and most interesting thing I did at PW before they were acquired by IBM, this is back in 2002, was to go across to Sweden and help them run their Tetra Pak project, which was before Nestlé the biggest global R3 project in the world. Mm. And that was just amazing to work there and meet a whole bunch of colleagues from all over the world. And then, of course, IBM came along, and it was okay, but I sort of wanted to move on. And then I joined SAP in 2007, and I ran the services business here in ANZ and did various other roles around the services business, and I was there for 12 years. And we'll probably touch on it, but I was there. I was very lucky because I was there. The only acquisition or major acquisition they'd made before I joined was Business Objects. Remember that name? Mm. and then, Bill wasn't the CEO at that point, although he soon became the global CEO. And then they acquired all sorts of other organisations like SuccessFactors and Ariba, etc. So being inside the beast during all of those acquisitions was just fascinating. They started to think about the cloud and what that meant, and also, of course, the financial subscription model, what that meant. And we'll probably touch on that a little bit today with the S4 movement. The introduction of HANA as a database, because when I first joined, again, many of you would be nodding, it was either Oracle or DB2 or SQL, and that was about it. And of course, SAP just hated the fact that whenever they licensed their software, they had to pay part of that to those other organizations. So then HANA was introduced, and once we sort of realized what that meant, it was like, oh my God, this is going to be amazing. And of course, it took a long time for it to get sort of robust and so forth. But again, being inside during that was fantastic. Sort of fast forward then to 2019. I just felt like I needed to challenge myself a little bit. So I decided to leave, and I went to EY for a year. Didn't really work out for various reasons, which I won't go into. But I then left.
It's a safe space, Bruce.
But. Yeah, that's right. Well,
we can redact this bit.
White people no, I'm here, so I've got to be a little bit careful.
Mark can wear his hat off for the day.
I just felt as though EY wanted to sort of go into the SAP business, but when it came down to the investment required, it was a little bit difficult. And
things have changed.
There
Bruce.
You go. Good to see Mr. Irwin. If only I'd waited, right? So I left, and then I started looking around. An Accenture sort of came knocking, and I thought, well, that'll be interesting to go back to Accenture after 30 years. But I spent my last 2.5 years or so of my career at Accenture, and I initially was running the ANZ business, and then I was running the APJ business, which was just brilliant. Then I decided to retire 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry, probably a long answer to your question.
No, what a journey.
So I guess, but just to obviously have the luxury or the I was very fortunate to start in the whole R2 world and the mainframe world, and then just to see the client server being introduced with R3, and then the cloud, and consumption via the internet, and just then all the acquisitions, and then the database transformation. It's just been a blast. So again, like a lot of people, not just in this room, but I've bet my whole career on SAP, and it's been fantastic, right? I mean, it's just the ability to interact with a whole bunch of different clients, which has been probably the best element of my career, but then a whole bunch of other people just in the whole ecosystem has just been brilliant.
Brilliant.
So very lucky.
Well, thank you for giving us that,
yeah,
that background, Bruce. Yeah, on to today's topic around S4s. You know, it's a whole gulf of, you could talk about anything, but what specifically are you going to focus on today? Yeah.
Well, I guess and you know, obviously as part of you inviting me on to do this again and our preparation calls, and you wanted to sort of, not just you, but we decided that it was going to be a very, I think, interesting sort of topic. When we open it up to more of a discussion and questions, that'd be brilliant, because I'd like to hear everybody else's perspective as well. But the whole S4 journey is, it's still happening, of course. It's still evolving. I think it was, we first sort of released or introduced in 2015, which is, what, 10 years ago now. And the whole question around, you know, will a client move to S4? If they do, why? And probably more importantly, when? And should they jump, you know, now, or have they already jumped? Should they jump in the future? What's SAP as an organization's role in terms of helping the clients sort of make that decision? That's really, I think, what we're talking about. So, I mean, I wanted to focus a lot on things like the business case and why would a client actually make that investment decision? Are they putting the right business case on the table? And then the people who are deciding on the business case, and even before we were talking about a couple of examples of where a business goes, actually, we just don't want to do this right now. And is it a problem if we wait? And of course, that's another question. Is it, you know, how long should they wait? And will it become a problem? And what are the pitfalls or the problems in actually saying no to that? I think the last sort of, yeah, ever since 2015, I was still at SAP, EY, Accenture, those questions were coming at us thick and fast. Mm. And they still are, I believe, in terms of making that call.
Well, let's dive straight into that first point there around business cases. Have you got any success stories, and what are the common pitfalls that customers should be aware of?
Yeah, I think, well, you probably start with pitfalls, I'd say. I think the first point I'd make is what's the business problems you're trying to solve? So, and many clients actually don't really know the answer to that question, I found, in my experience. It's like, okay, well, SAP is telling us we've got to go before 2027. Or is it 2030? And even as we're doing some research the last couple of days, 2033, if you're a very large enterprise. Yeah. Now, you can understand from SAP's point of view why they're doing that, because, what is it, only 40% of ECC customers globally have actually moved or have actually indicated a decision to move. I think you have to ask yourself, why is that? And has SAP themselves articulated well enough to actually indicate these are the reasons why they should be changing? So I think the first big pitfall I would mention is most people assume that there's actually going to be true business process benefit from the change. And I would say that in many cases, there's really not, is there? Because ECC has been SAP's biggest success, you know, ever since they started 50 years ago. It's brilliant. It's almost bulletproof. It works. It costs an awful lot for many clients to put it in. So they're going, why would we disrupt that now? So the case for change is, I think, probably the biggest question. Of course, we all know that there's going to be increasing challenges, especially as you get close to that maintenance deadline. Obviously, beyond whatever deadline it is, there's no innovation left in the platform. There's potential risks around cyber and so forth. I mean, that's often thrown on the table as a real reason to move. I think, yes, it's a risk. I mean, how much of that actually justifies the business case? It's probably another question. Mm-hmm. So I found probably one of the biggest problems is it's not clear why you would do it and when. So that's the first pitfall. In terms of success, I think that's, if you flip it on its head, that's the first question to answer is, okay, we know we need to do something here. If there's a genuine, like, internal change or compelling reason, then that's great. And I would say most of the clients that have gone S4 needed to do something for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Mm. So be it they had, you know, the system was creaking, or they wanted to move to the new platform, and they were helped by SAP and partners to achieve that. But I would say the success to me is a well-formulated business case with the right amount of, or the right appetite for change. And then you have, as part of that, you've got questions like, how much scope do we include or not? I won't mention the client's name, but one of the clients we were working with when I was still at Accenture put a huge amount of effort into a business case, but they couldn't resist the temptation to include all sorts of stuff. And then by the time you sort of tallied it all up in terms of cost and impact and change, it's like, we can't digest that. And the board looked at it and basically said, No chance, no way. So you've got to maintain that balance, right? So it's all about that business case and really having the right business problem just to solve.
And I think that's where so many of our clients are struggling at the moment. The people in this room, you have these conversations. I was even just having a coffee with someone at a company that shall not be named this morning. They mentioned even changes at a C-level. You'll have these conversations for 6 months and then all of a sudden a new CIO will come in and they're like, well, we need to start again.
Yes.
Because I don't agree with anything they've said.
Yes.
So when in your career, the last 30 years, have you stepped into that boardroom and you're like, okay, we need to steer this ship in the right direction?
Yeah.
How did you do it?
Well, you touch on a great point, which is, and it's very tempting for any new C-level exec to go, everything before me was rubbish, so I've got to recreate the whole plan again. So I've seen some really mature people that I have highly respected who have not fallen for that temptation. And I guess as a whatever organization you're representing, or even if you're just advising, if you can advise them to go, okay, well, not everything about the old plan was bad, let's take the good stuff and let's put in place the right model to work with. But another point I'd make, and again, this is always sort of mentioned, but having that right business ownership. So as well as understanding the business problem that you're trying to solve is who's actually driving this from a business representation point of view. And this comes back to who is therefore really going to be ideally the sponsor of the program, the chair of the steering committee, what kind of support do they have in the broader business, and also what kind of board support do they have. I think I just touched on an example where the board sort of looked at a business case and they went, no, it's too much money, it's too risky, and by the way, don't all SAP implementations fail, because that's what board members think, right? A lot of, to be honest, and I've interacted with a lot of board members, they're usually either accountants or lawyers. Very few actually have significant technology transformation, and the first thing you mentioned about SAP, they go, Queensland Health or whatever. And these are, war
poor
stories.
Or Queensland Health.
Yeah, that's right.
To this day is still the war story everyone mentions.
That's right. And of course, when you dig into any of these sorts of problems, there's a lot of reasons why they didn't work out. But arguably, a lot of it's because they didn't have the right level of business commitment. And when things go wrong, because they always go wrong, is that sponsor going to step up and say, we're going to make a decision? Is my back covered by my colleagues? And then obviously having everybody sort of in the rowboat together, be it the vendor, be it the SI, are they in there together to work through the problem as opposed to pointing fingers at everybody? And I've seen lots of situations, unfortunately, where it's fallen apart.
So Bruce, have you got any examples of, there's a lot of challenges there. Have you got any examples of where you've influenced people like that into get a project up and running?
Yeah, like you mean, I probably won't mention the client name, but it was an energy generator in Melbourne. So you'll probably figure it out, but this is when I was actually at SAP, and one of the things I used to love doing at SAP was to be the SAP representative on a lot of these transformation programs. So I was on 6 or 8 steering committees at a time, which was difficult, but anyway. But this particular environment, and a lot of it was set up for success even before I arrived, and they had originally been advised by a very dear old colleague of mine. I'll mention his name, Chris Bennett. I don't know if any of you know Chris. I worked with Chris when I was at Pricewaterhouse, and he then sort of moved into the advisory sort of space. So he would advise various clients at the exec level. And he had basically convinced this client to put in place the right business case and the right support. So they had the CEO wasn't the sponsor, but he regularly dropped into Steerco's. And there was even a board member, a non-executive director, and that's rare, or at least in my experience, to have them attend. And they didn't know a lot about technology, so they were really, but she had the right attitude to really learn a lot about what was coming up in the next sort of 2, 3, 4 months in the project. And then when we had the problems, usual problems, data, change management. In this case, it was a very highly unionized workforce. So there was some initial union resistance for any kind of change to the day-to-day workload. They just worked it through, and it was a very positive can-do attitude. So I guess my advice was to continue with that, and in that case was to represent SAP's efforts to make sure that we aligned with that. So after that, I basically advised those sorts of key points on every single steering committee I was on. In some cases, sometimes you could see it wasn't set up for success, and then you have the conversation with the sponsor, and if they're willing to change, great. If they're not, you go, okay, well, good luck, because it might not work.
And you mentioned that a common pitfall is just that question of when enough is enough, and you're building this business case.
Yep.
You've got one business stakeholder come in and just saying like, oh, it'd be nice if I could keep this.
Yep.
When do you know when to draw the line, and how do you communicate that to a business stakeholder effectively?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I was going to say the $64 million problem, and sometimes it's a lot more than that. when they're trying to construct the right plan, and look, a lot of clients will kick the tires of the SI community and sometimes get, let's call it, some free consulting to respond to the RFPs and all that sort of stuff, and that's okay. I mean, everyone knows that's the game.
That's happening a lot at the minute.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's good because obviously, you hope that the client is listening to all sorts of different stakeholders and they're being well advised. But I think my guide to that question is about when is the business, what does the business need? What's its cycle? What's its timing? And once you sort of understand that, and the key stakeholders understand that as well, then it's a lot easier, including sometimes the timing of the SI and the SAP. So SAP will put some commercial levers on the table and say, if you jump, this quarter, you'll get a better deal. Okay, whatever. But understanding all of those sorts of cycles about where the pressure points are is really important. But then making that decision to go, that is gold. I saw so many examples of where the client just did not go. And okay, fair enough, they weren't ready. But when they're ready to go, and that's almost a big signal for everybody involved, okay, well, now we're serious, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's grab it while it's there. Yeah.
We probably all hope that a lot of clients do that this year, I'm sure. So
don't we all?
Yeah, exactly.
It's definitely been the avalanche is coming. There's a lot of customers that have been kicking the can down the road for a number of years now. But yeah, I definitely think it's coming. That's why it's good that we're doing things like this. But I want to shift the conversation, Bruce, to all those buzzwords that SAP have.
Yes.
And SAP are going through a transformation themselves. And
yes,
there's buzzwords like RISE and AI and BTP. And you've worked for the mothership at SAP. And what would your advice be to customers and all the people in the room about how to navigate?
Good question. The first answer I would say is make sure they explain it to you properly, and justify why they're positioning what they're positioning. And let's be honest, SAP themselves have cycled through a huge personnel change, and they've had to do that because when I was working there, it was brilliant, but there were a lot of people like me who had been around since the 80s, right? Old crusty white men, and I apologize to everybody else in that category. So that kind of generational change was really important. And of course, part of that was for commercial or financial reasons. They really needed to, reduce their cost. So there's an awful lot of people have come into SAP who are learning. They're learning their craft, their trade. So they will get told by their sales manager or whoever, go and sell RISE. And it's like, well, what is RISE? you know, and we probably all remember the early days of the RISE. It's like, what does it really mean? And SAP themselves didn't really understand that it was more than just selling a new software license or even via subscription. It was an infrastructure deal as well. And then the clients are going, SAP selling me infrastructure? You know, what does that mean? What are my service levels? You know, do I do disaster? All of that kind of stuff. So I think obviously time's moved on and they're a lot better at it than they used to be. But I think that's the important thing is, okay, well, let's workshop this together in terms of why you're trying to position what you're positioning. And then let's work through all of these things. So another good example would be BTP. Why do people want to use BTP? That's a good question. I mean, I'm sure there's probably 15 different answers in this room, right, in terms of why they would do that. And of course, you know, SAP needs to see a much more modern sort of development and integration type of platform, which ultimately is what they're trying to achieve with that. Again, you need to work through all those sorts of things. So I think the answer is just knowledge and then, you know, talking to people, not just from SAP, but from other parts of the market as well to work through that. Because buzzwords are buzzwords. I mean, everyone's got them. So
speaking of greenfield, brownfield, bluefield, probably the most important buzzwords.
Obviously, I'm advising SNP, as I mentioned before. Some of you might have heard of them. I've had to learn a little bit as well in the last sort of 18 months or so. And I think at the end of the day, greenfield versus brownfield is one of the key questions that a lot of, you know, clients will ask themselves. And there's no single simple sort of answer to that question. It depends a lot on what's the state of their current environment, ECC. Are they fairly clean or not? The obviously a greenfield is going to be more of a new re-implementation that's going to represent more of a larger scale transformation with change management and data implications. But then again, so does brownfield. One of the clients that I worked with a lot just before I retired was one of the large global mining organizations. Again, you can probably figure it out who it is. And they had sort of just, well, in the recent years, they had spent well over $1 billion on their ECC implementation. So they didn't want to go greenfield and they didn't need to go greenfield. So they just wanted the lowest cost technology transfer possible. But even then they needed to go through a lot of the design of S4 and go, okay, well, we're going to have to adapt this and that and this. We're going to have to potentially, you know, redesign some of this sort of custom code. And think about our application architecture to even do the transformation at all. So it's all very specific. I think of other clients, and when I first started working with SAP, some of these clients did early R3 implementations in the late 90s, and they really haven't done much since then, apart from building a huge amount of custom code to support their business. So they've got real difficult challenges. And again, they just have to work through it. And think about what it all means. A quick sort of plug. Obviously, SNP is not the only one. There are a number of other organisations as well where they do this thing called selective data transition. The idea being that you can take advantage of the knowledge to do straight table-to-table migrations. It can speed things up if you've got, you know, downtime issues or challenges or constraints. And you can also retire some data and think about if you've got to merge your companies or whatever. So there's some opportunities there. So obviously the pitch of these sorts of organizations is you should really think about these sorts of additional software. SAP has their own software. They do. It's quite expensive.
What?
Yes, I know right. But then again, some organizations like the client I mentioned, they went that direction because they wanted to have SAP's sort of throat on the block, so to speak. So fair enough. That's the way they wanted to go.
Yeah, questions of liability always need to be asked.
But again, there's no single answer to this. But again, I think a lot of clients find themselves getting tied up in knots, you know. And if it's the CIO and his team or her team, which is tabling this business case, going, okay, well, we really don't want to have a huge business transformation because I don't think I've got the support to do that. But then again, I've got so much complexity built into the existing ECC system, they're going to have to do something. That's where it gets difficult.
It really is that balance of I've just gotten my ECC system exactly where I want it to be.
Yeah.
What a time to have to gut it all now.
That's right. And I sort of mentioned it before, but you've got to admire ECC's functionality and its breadth of scope. It's brilliant. I mean, it's and of course it's very sticky as well. So once a client's got ECC, it's very difficult to consider a non-SAP solution. Mm. Some do, but it's most of them don't. So yeah, that's another reason. It's a very big moat, and it's almost their own biggest problem, because
it's done so well.
Yeah, exactly. It's very difficult, or can be difficult anyway.
So in terms of those programs that you mentioned, what support do they need to get these projects over the line?
Yeah, the first thing I would say there is you just need experience and knowledge. That's why I think you'll see a lot of clients building their own internal capability. And obviously, hopefully, choosing the right partner and to work with. But it's whenever you're trying to answer some of these complex challenges, it's just understanding what are the pros and cons and the pitfalls and the tips and tricks that you really they could fall into. I was talking to somebody just the other day, and they're going into a government department, and unfortunately they really don't have much SAP experience at all inside that government department. So and then they talk to SAP, and let's be honest, the rep might not have a lot of experience themselves, and it's difficult then to really, you know, work through. So just having that knowledge. And then I think I've touched on it before, who in the business is really willing to sponsor and really, you know, get their hands dirty on this problem or this project. What is life look like sort of during that program and beyond, and preparing all the stakeholders and everybody involved to work through that. It sounds easy, right? But
it does sound easy, yeah.
We all know it's difficult. Or can be difficult.
All right. Well, at this point, we're going to open it up to a Q&A session. Before we move on, looking around the room, there's a lot of knowledge here. So we'd love to interview you if you want to be in the hot seat after Bruce.
Time to plug.
That's our time to plug, yeah. But, like I said, there's a lot of knowledge in the room here. So, like I said, if you want to be interviewed, just grab us afterwards and we can definitely organise a time. Might not be a live setting like this, don't worry, but definitely in the podcast room over there. All right. But we've got some questions. Thank you for sending these through before. We've got one from Paul Freeman. Paul, I don't know if you want me to read it out, or can you remember your question?
I can't remember it.
Paul, your mother-in-law, what's she doing? So Paul said, any tips on a business case focusing from a business benefit, especially from a customer from an ECC background and with the aim of getting the project off the ground?
Yeah, I think, well, we sort of touched on that a little bit already, but in fact, Paul and I were having a chat before this, so I now understand more of the background behind that question. But as I kind of hinted, unless there's some very specific business process in advantages, that's not going to cut it in many cases. And it's going to be difficult for the business owner or the business, you know, CEO to go, you know, why do I need to spend whatever, $100 million plus on this? I think one thing I would say is most organizations would have a business case which is not just looking at cost, although of course that's a big important dimension. They're looking at things like risk and scenarios. And I don't know if we want to sort of spread into things like geopolitical circumstances at the moment, but a lot of big organizations will be looking at that going, okay, what does that really mean? And one of the dynamics, of course, is, again, you know, at some point SAP will stop maintenance. So what does that really mean? And what is the actual technical risk of not being on a platform which is maintained, upgraded, responded to if there's not just things like cyber problems, but also local regulatory issues to solve, and it's not being innovated at all. Mm. So if you need to do something within your business, ultimately it's just not going to cut it for the long term. So a good business case can monetize that. So you can look at the scenario and go, okay, well, here are some scenarios, and this is what might happen, and this is what the additional cost of the business might be. So we're going to have to do something at some point. So being able to sort of build that in. So that's one thing I would say. And then obviously, as part of that innovation question, looking at what the business needs to do to really remain current with their customers and with their stakeholders, and looking at what can happen there. Being really honest, I would say I don't think SAP is done a great job looking at topics like cloud analytics, business process, mining. Obviously, they have some answers to those questions. And of course, the big one, AI at the moment. So what is the SAP AI strategy? I mean, I'm retired, so I don't need to know anymore, right? But I'm pretty sure that SAP themselves, you know, they are not articulating that answer very well. And they need to. Maybe Business Data Cloud, I hear that's been released, whatever that means. So maybe that's the answer.
Databricks, Bruce. Databricks.
There you go. So, but you know what? These board members, who I said before, many of them are not technologically literate. They have heard all this thing about AI. You know, how are we using ChatGPT? You know, what's the SAP, you know, answer to that? It's got to be answered at some point. So that's important that gets done. Because your owner will come back, or the CEO will come back and ask that question at some point, the CIO. And if they don't have a good answer to that, they need to.
While we have that, there was also a question from Angeline Cable around cost realization benefits.
Yeah.
How do you go about kind of calculating them in flight as you go on?
That's a good question. You mean during the project itself?
Yeah.
So I guess, every program should have a good and clear and transparent business case. So that can be understood or should be understood, and there should be a benefits realization program to go through that. So in the case of where there's no obvious business process benefits, and you're not asking your supply chain guy to stand up to, you know, percentage improvement in delivery metrics or whatever, same thing with the CFO, then there's that risk dynamic. So if you can actually monetize that and calculate it, then you can say, okay, we're avoiding this. So that should be measured. And of course, we've all been involved in projects where you kind of put the business case in the drawer before the project starts, but that's obviously the wrong thing to do. So
maybe just building on that, pretty volatile times out there at the moment. My sense is putting more value on agility could be quite compelling in terms of business case.
Yeah.
Any experience in terms of?
I think that's spot on. Yeah. It's it's interesting. I have a financial advisor. I don't have a lot of money but just to be clear. But one of the things I really value from the financial advisor is they actually put a bit of homework into scenarios analysis. So, and then when you've got, you know, well, you haven't got the income coming in, and you've got your declining, you know, portfolio, what's happening at the moment, then to be able to understand that and think about, okay, well, here's what's going on. I think that's really helpful from a business case perspective, it's almost like I just touched on. So when you're talking to the business owners, and they're going, okay, well, you've got this. We spent, you know, $100 million on this ECC program, you know, 10 years ago. To be able to really workshop with them those sorts of questions around, well, is that really, obviously it's running our business, which is great, and it's bulletproof, which is great, but if we wanted to go into a new market, if we wanted to launch a new product line, if we wanted to think about an acquisition, or if we think about being acquired, what would we do with that? And we all know that these platforms are quite clunky in those sorts of scenarios. So that's another element I would encourage, is to say to the CFO, is like, well, you can't come to me with 3 months' notice and go, we're about to acquire another organization here, and expect the SAP system just to turn on like that, right? It doesn't work like that. Now, hopefully a good CFO would understand that and include their technology team in those sorts of conversations. But there's all sorts of scenarios out there. And I think that, to your point, sort of throwing some of those scenarios on the table and going, well, here's what we would need to do, and here's what would happen if we didn't do that, then that would be problematic. It's a bit of a motherhood type answer to your question, but you kind of know what I mean. It's almost one thing that I've learned through my interactions, especially on steering committees in working with boards, is trying to talk in their language. So important, because as you said before, the buzzwords, it's like they don't know what BTP means. But to say, okay, well, you're obviously concerned about the business performance of this part of your business. Maybe we could help them out with our technology to actually provide some better data or reporting or whatever to be able to support them with that. So, but you know what? At some point we're going to have to bite the bullet and go to this new platform.
Does that answer the question, Steve?
Yeah. Brilliant.
I've had a couple of phone calls and conversations with Mark Ullman here over the last couple of months, and he said, make sure you grill Bruce, make sure you grill him. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to grill Bruce with your question.
Yeah, I'll pass it up.
There you go. I'll start it out with
nice to see you again, Mark.
Good to see you too, Bruce.
I worked together at Accenture, and I very much enjoyed our conversations that we had.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and I got I seeked advice before I made a career change from Bruce, and it was so far very helpful. So I started out with an easy one. What does SNP stand for?
Oh my goodness! I actually did know that, but I've you've stumped
me. There you comes the know. German Schneider, Neureuther and Partner, which is
there.
There you go. That's it. It's more meaningful than systems, applications, programs like SAP.
That's true.
But
that's
Schneider, true. Neureuther and Partner. Yeah, and
I failed my first test. Don't you all feel? I didn't know.
So
that.
I think the insights that you're sharing are really, really helpful, and I see that reflected in some of the discussions that we're having on the ground now. The reference that you made before to the mining company, they're still at it. By the way, slowly chipping away. the question I wanted to ask you was, if you're looking at the market right now, and obviously the everybody knows that the investment in the SAP systems is just really, really significant. So how can you make it as easy as possible? Companies like SNP have that tool set. It almost feels like, it's like when you call SNP or when you call Natuvion or CVS, they come with that real big tool bag on, all right, so we do that surgery and we can get rid of the past and we can selectively move to the new. Mm. With SNP just making a major decision end of last year and taking an investment of the Carlyle Group, that kind of gives a bit of wings to what you can actually do. So I'd be keen to hear your perspective on where do you see SNP today versus how do you see that evolving in the future?
Yeah, and you're quite right. So Carlyle, big venture capital or private equity organization, has decided to invest. It's good for SNP's journey. It'll be interesting days for them over the next couple of years to see how that plays out. And obviously, private equity is a huge part of the entire technology market. And of course, they're no fools. They would look at an organization and go, okay, we're going to get a return out of this. I think to answer your question, SNP's been around for 30 years now. So they've have developed an awful lot of IP and experience around SAP upgrades, ultimately, and knowledge of the underlying data structures is a big part of that. And yes, they have tools, as you say, Natuvion and CBS and others have got similar sorts of tools. And I would hope that most clients would at least have a look at them and say, okay, well, we're going to learn something even by going through a pre-sales process. Maybe we won't invest, whatever, because organizations like SNP will spend some effort to actually help understand the makeup of the data, and it'll help you answer questions like, okay, well, can we archive some of this stuff, or do we need to clean it before we, or how much do we need to clean, and so forth. Obviously, SNP, like a lot of organisations, is looking with a lot of interest and let's call it glee around the supposed S4 migration curve that's coming or that is upon us, and trying to make sure it's positioned well to harvest as much of that as possible. Which and Phil has had to rebuild a lot of the organization here in this part of the world. And that's why he wanted me to help him with that. One of the first questions I had of him and others in SNP was, okay, that's great, but what about life beyond S4, which you're probably hinting at? I'm not a technical person, you maybe used to be, but not anymore. They are announcing or have released a new product called Kiano, which encompasses some of the existing technology, but the idea is it becomes an ongoing data platform which can help maintain some of the agility that we talked about before. If Kiano has an ongoing role to keep some level of control and alignment of the SAP data, then okay, you can answer some of those questions about, okay, if we want to acquire or divest or whatever, then this can help you with that. So ultimately they're hoping to do that. And then the same question, is AI going to be part of that? So SNP, like a lot of organizations, is asking itself that question. I'm not, unfortunately, able to answer that question because I haven't received a satisfactory answer myself yet to that. But we'll get there, I'm sure.
To come.
Yeah, well, you'd hope so, right? I mean, and I guess it comes back again to Business Data Cloud. If that can be truly sort of used as a tool to actually really throw agentic AI at, then that's going to be amazing. Because look at the, if you've got good data, you need good data, right, for AI to work. It's theoretically it should be brilliant. So hopefully that will happen.
We've also got one question from Matt Youngman, who I can read out here. Organizations that are new to SAP can feel completely out of their depth with new SAP terms. There's jargon. There's a fear they may no longer be the experts of their business as the program changes process, technology, ways of working. There's a real general fear, I think, of being lost in a transformation program. How do you go about reassuring them in those cases and minimizing panic as the organization embarks on what can be a new SAP implementation?
Yeah, and I sort of touched on before about making sure that SAP actually explain properly these sorts of terms. That's really important. But the other point I'll make is, and I think all of us in the room here would agree, that part of our job is to help explain to clients who don't know these sorts of things what it really means. So translating it into terms which they can understand, whether they're technologists but not necessarily experienced at SAP, or whether they're just business people. So as I sort of mentioned before, even when you're talking to very senior executives and trying to translate it into their language is really important. So that's the best way, I would say. And I think the other thing is I made the mistake when I first started advising exec teams and boards that of trying to take them through too much detail. When somebody would say, like, again, unfortunately, we'll raise again, Queensland Health, what happened there? So I'd actually try to answer that, and then, like, an hour later, I'm still answering it. And it's like, no, you need to sort of take it up a level to the kind of attention span of that particular person. And in some cases, they will want to hear that detail, but in other cases, they'll go, you know what, I'm not interested in it. Just tell me in 5 minutes what happened.
I reckon our MD is...
Yeah. 20 minutes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's 20 seconds sometimes.
It's true, especially if they don't have the background, they really, you can lose them in the detail.
Yeah. I was going to say our MD would be absolutely frothing because we talk about this all the time. It's just a simple case of mirroring.
Yeah.
Are you speaking with someone who wants the detail, or is this a high level person who's like, oh my God, I've got a problem. I don't care.
Yeah.
Fix it. Come on, just get me there.
Yeah. And I used to use a technique which at least worked for me. When I'm meeting a brand new exec, especially if it's a difficult situation, often I have to go into situations where the program's going poorly or there's technology issues or whatever, and I always before we started getting to that, I just ask them about their business and what's going on, and everyone wants to talk about their business, right?
I mean,
and all of a sudden you're creating a conversation where they're feeling more comfortable, and then you develop some rapport, and it just goes from there. Didn't work always though.
You have to try.
You've got to try, exactly.
All right, it's another good question for Matt. Thanks for sending them through again. But he mentioned often S4 implementations, they start their life as an IT initiative to replace, obviously, their legacy ERP. But then they morph into business transformation for various reasons. Do you think it's necessary for a major SAP implementation to be transformational? And if not, why? And if so, why?
It's sort of like a spectrum, isn't it? It's sort of like they're all transformational. And, of course, the more transformational, might mean more expensive. And again, it just depends on the circumstances and the business problem that they have as to what they're prepared to do. So, like I mentioned before, we've touched on it a couple of times now, this particular organization, very, very large global company, they had just invested a huge amount of money. They just wanted to do a technology transfer, but even that itself was going to be complex. But really, their sort of acid test was, we don't really want the business to be worried about it. And we want them to sort of feel as though it's just a seamless transition. And of course, they wanted the project to go live. And then, of course, you've got the other end of the spectrum where, for whatever reason, the organization's happy or is willing to go through a greenfield sort of almost from scratch sort of transformation. And then it's a completely different conversation. So I would say, and again, like I just touched on, if you're talking to a stakeholder, sometimes they might want to hear, you know what, we're going to make this as seamless as possible. We don't want to impact your business. We don't want your users to have to worry about it. And this is how we're going to structure this. But we all know that under the hood, there's still a fair bit of work to do. And making that sort of well-planned and clear is the challenge, isn't it? So So I don't think it's black or white, is it? It's on the spectrum at the end of the day.
We've got one question as well from old colleague, Lisa Peters. Mm. What's your take on the fact that in the last 12 months, we've seen SAP change their tune around greenfield versus brownfield on SAP
Rise? I was going to ask you, I'm not really in the market that much anymore. Were they initially saying we only want greenfield, or and now they're allowing more brownfield? Is that what's happening, or? Yeah, yeah.
Because it had to be greenfield and clean core and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
We're definitely seeing a lot more just
get it done.
Get it done.
Yeah.
Don't care.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of asked and answered, isn't it? I mean, again, I would say when Rise was first introduced, there was all the language that everybody started talking about around clean core and all of that kind of stuff. I was like, what does that really mean? And of course, okay, well, we don't really want to go to Rise, you know, unless it's really clean and green and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know what? When you dig into a situation of an R3 customer who did their project in 1995, mm-hmm. and it's now, 30 years old, there's a lot of crap in it. But we can't afford a $200 million project. So I think SAP is going, oh, okay, yeah, just however we'll get there. Just don't go onto Rimini Street and don't go onto Oracle. That sort of thing. That's at the end of the day, that's the kind of language that a lot of the SAP reps understand. So that's pretty obvious. That's what's happening, isn't it? They want to see that.
It's an interesting comment, Bruce. Just more recently, some of the organisations I've spoken to, there's been at least two that have said, you know, we've been on ECC, to your point, very expensive for us to move off that into S/4HANA.
Yeah.
We're looking at Microsoft Dynamics.
Yeah.
365, it's a lot cheaper. It's still expensive, but it's nowhere near the... and I've implemented 365, sorry.
That's right.
I know. Why'd you hire me into SAP?
What are you doing in this room?
That's right.
Who invited him? No, sorry, just kidding.
No.
I know Conwell, so...
Yeah, that's right. It's becoming... from a sample of two clients, I'm assuming others are looking at it as well. Yeah.
Well, you look at organisations like Microsoft or... some of the cloud providers like Workday and Salesforce and so forth. I mean, how do you talk to an SAP customer? These are the kinds of things you talk about. And there's probably no doubt that in some cases, depending on how you compare them, it might be cheaper. But what are the, like I said before, what are the longer term consequences of that? Is Dynamics going to be the right platform for you going forward? Is Microsoft the right organization to work with? Maybe, maybe not. It's definitely a factor. And hopefully SAP is commercially being as sharp as possible to defend themselves against those sorts of conversations. I think in my experience, sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But then of course it takes a brave, CIO to completely change platform, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So that's the other dynamic is going, okay, well, ECC used to be bulletproof. Is Dynamics going to be as equally as functional? Maybe in some cases it is. I don't know Microsoft very well, so.
It's looser.
Well, I guess that's the other dynamic is, I mean, I hinted at it in my early career was the ability to configure a platform with it, but there's always been highly structured, right? It's been very Germanic in its approach to it. These other platforms are not quite as structured. And so you can do an awful lot in there, right? But then again, how easy to upgrade and innovate on and all that kind of stuff. So these are all the sort of levers that you hope an organization is considering beyond just the straight cost. So... because that's why it's up to us to actually help them craft a business case that does that. So,
excellent. All right. Well, we'll open questions up to the floor. We've got one more here before we enjoy the rest of the food and the beers and the wine before we wrap up. But yes, a question from Jack Elsukan. I think he's one of your colleagues at EY, Mark. But he mentioned obviously this is right now. They're seeing a surge at the minute of government customers asking for brownfield. Whereas private sectors are asking for more, being more selective with Bluefield. Is there any correlation or do you think it's a coincidence?
That's an interesting one, isn't it? I would say that, I'll just talk in the context of SNP. And arguably you could say that Nativion and CBS are probably behind SNP in terms of its market sort of penetration and so forth. SNP kind of went through some initial success, mainly in the private sector, for sure. And then it sort of Had some organizational challenges, and now that's being rebuilt, as I sort of hinted at. I think the biggest answer to that is awareness. Do the public clients know about these sorts of solutions? And when the public sector chooses to make a decision, they have to go through all of their own sort of challenges. I mean, I would argue that from a risk management perspective, it's good to have these sorts of organizations, but a lot of government buyers, I would say, will go, well, who is SNP? You know, as an organization, do we want to have them on our books? Are they going to be mature and so forth? And that they just don't know. Whereas SAP, of course, everyone knows who SAP is. So I think it's an awareness thing, because arguably you could say it can help you with your transition and your risk profile, but they have to know that. So that would be my answer to that.
Okay. Hey, Bruce, I got a question. I think I'm one of the few people who hasn't worked with you before.
Well, very nice to meet you. Yeah, exactly. Lucky man.
My name is Alpa from NTT Data, and lots of great questions. But I wanted to ask, what was the failure you learned the most from in your career?
Oh, my goodness.
And you can take your time. So we are here.
Yeah.
So.
Thanks, Alpa. Nice to meet you, by the way. Yeah, I'm taking my time. There's a client, and again, I won't mention the name, and probably one of the most challenging times in my career was when I was representing SAP at some of these transformation projects. And to be honest, SAP got itself involved in some solutions which, to be honest, they shouldn't have. And I'm talking about industry solutions, not necessarily the big ones like utilities and so forth, but some other solutions. I'll mention point of sale, which probably give you an indication. So what I learned being the SAP representative in this governance process, where the organization and, of course, you know, retail industry is tough. You know, it's one of the toughest industries, arguably, to work in. The kind of razor thin margins, and it's just crucial that you get it right. But point of sale is notoriously a very custom developed type sort of solution, and I would say SAP as an organization just does not do custom development very well, never has, albeit they used to have a CDP group which was quite lucrative, but at the end of the day it's more about package software. So I learned a lot during that particular experience about the pressure points of being successful in that kind of project as opposed to a traditional ERP type program. And it kind of made me want to go back to ERP, to be honest. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it was a very interesting experience.
I just heard in the audience that the biggest mistake might have been EY. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. There is many opportunities within that organization, and strategies change. Yeah. But I wanted to pick up the comment from
I'll
the.
Give you a little bit more color around that if you want me to. But anyway.
Yeah. There you go. I just wanted to pick up the comment before, and we haven't met. Yeah. I'll do that one later. Yeah. But it's indeed what we very much see in the market is customers looking more around, and it's very much also the comment that I made in the podcast that we done together, Jay, where it actually doesn't matter which direction you're going as long as you actually make up your mind. And I think that's exactly the point where we are, right? So there is plenty options, and each of them have their pros and their cons and limits and what you need to work with. And for senior executives in client organizations, often these are very, very much career defining choices. Yeah, so it's a matter of having an informed, more making an informed decision. But I think it's really the part where you need to define your principles. You need to understand what's valuable to you, and then you need to put yourself onto a pathway to success. And I think we've learned a lot tonight on what are certain things to actually get right. And very much, as always, appreciate the views. but it's not always SAP. Yeah, and that's the organization obviously has certain characteristics that a company needs to be comfortable with. But I think it's still a great solution out there. And it's all about just making up your mind.
No, I think it's spot on. Just without going into another rabbit hole, because we might be wrapping up, another great example of that is public versus private, isn't it? Yes. And that's the one that sprang to my mind when you talked about that.
Different podcast.
We'll be back next month, Ashley. Same place, same time.
Yeah. Well, I won't. otherwise,
you're right. Yeah. There's a big discussion to be had.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Bruce. That's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Take the drinks.
But yeah, like I said, please stay and enjoy the beers and food and wine. And like I said, if anyone's interested in sharing their views, like I said, there's a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge in here. Please grab us afterwards and we can sort out a time. But Bruce, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Well, can I just thank you as well, just from Precision Sourcing in particular. And I guess just to share with the audience that we got to know each other when I was at Accenture, and coming out of COVID, we had a real challenge, which was to attract and bring in talent into our organization at scale. And one of the good things about Accenture is that when it does scale, it does scale. So we needed to bring in a huge number of people, and we got to know each other pretty well. And I have to say that the quality of service, and I'm not just saying this because I'm enjoying your drinks.
And you're on our podcast.
on your podcast, was really, really strong. So, and I love the idea about having these sorts of forums. I mean, others can be the judge about tonight's, but being able to then just share, provide an opportunity for people to share their ideas and their questions, I think is fantastic. So well done.
Excellent. Thank you, Bruce.